morning. My name is Joe Lehrer, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 26, 1991. I just need to let you know that I think we all should announce our sobriety dates whenever we get up to share. For one simple reason, at least we know how long to listen. You know what I mean? And when I first started coming around AA, I couldn't get a sobriety date. I didn't have a sobriety date, and I had an awful lot to share, and I had absolutely nothing to say. The home group that I belong to is the Harbor City Speakers Group. It meets on Thursday nights at 8:30 up in South Baltimore. That's 701 South Charles Street, so if you're ever in the area, on Thursday nights, by all means, stop by. We insist, as the book talks about, on enjoying life. But, you know, we are not a glum lot there. I have a sponsor, and thank God that sponsor is no longer me. You know, I sponsored myself in AA for a while. I didn't know I was sponsoring myself in AA, but I found that after I got sober and went through the 12 steps is I've been a failure my whole life. Ever since I was a little kid, I felt like a failure. Everything about my life seemed like a failure. And even growing up, you know, I got married, had kids, you know, building a house and just having a job and everything that goes along with life in general, I was a complete failure by the time I got to AA. Complete failure. I was a failure as a father, a son, a human being, a friend, you know, a husband. And here I'm going to come to Alcoholics Anonymous being a complete failure in every area of my life. And I'm going to attempt to sponsor myself in AA. And I'm going to wonder, why am I having difficulties? It's real simple. At the end of my drinking, I ended up in the psychiatric ward of shock trauma hospital. And I didn't end up there because I had a drinking problem. I ended up there because I had a problem with sobriety. A big problem with sobriety. It's like every time I got sober, I got depressed. And those two things always went hand in hand for me. And I ended up there because I had this bad case of sobriety. And is what I mean about this bad case of sobriety is when I stopped drinking, I began to examine my life. And I don't know about you, but without God and AA and the 12 steps, me examining my life is like suicide. Because I can examine your life, and I kind of let most of you off the hook. But when I examine my life, I like put me under a magnifying glass. And I just dissect everything about it. And if you're anything like me, when I do that, I got this big problem with an ego, and I can't live with that. And once I finally realized whose fault this was, you know, at my first treatment center, we went in there, we were going to discover whose fault this is. And is what that means is you blame your family, and that's what I did anyway. Maybe you guys are more honest than me, but I wasn't very honest in that place. But I blamed everybody for my problems. And is what happened between that time and the time I got to AA is it's a lot easier to surrender when there's nobody left to blame, you know. People call them enablers. I don't call them enablers. I call them people who love me. They wanted to help me. And they were killing me. You know, but I used every decent thing up in my life. And I ended up in this psychiatric ward because I ran my truck into a pole. I wanted out. I wanted this fight to end, and I didn't know how to end it. Maybe you're like me when I was coming around AA, and I was very tired. I was tired of pretending. I was tired of lying. I was tired of lying to you people. My life was falling apart. I was dying from the inside. And I couldn't die quick enough on the outside. And I couldn't tell anybody. I had to come here and pretend. And I did that for years. And I'm very grateful that I got to that point of where I had no other choice but to ask you for help. But I need to get up to that point. The only reason I share that is it's very important for me to try to get honest first. Because you got a better chance of getting the truth out of me. I've been a liar my whole life. And all of my lies have been based on one principle, and that principle is to impress you. Now, hopefully, by sharing what I was like right up front, it's a little late to try to impress you. You know, I was a complete failure. Just everything was a failure. But I didn't start out. I don't know when I became afraid. I don't know when I began to have all these difficulties in life. I don't know when my life went like kind of sour. All I know is somewhere around the age of 13, I began to drink. And is what I realized after I began to drink is I never realized how bad my life was until I really started drinking. You know, because it just seemed normal. It seemed normal to be afraid. I mean, it just, at a very young age, it seemed normal to be afraid. You know, my stepfather would yell at me and I'd like wet my pants, you know, and things like that. It seemed normal to do those kind of things. For me, anyway. I don't know about anybody else, but for me, it just seemed like life was very difficult as a young child. It's like I had the wrong parents, you know. I was born into the wrong family. I was born without money. You know? I was born and it's like I was put on this planet and I had no purpose. And if I did have a purpose, I sure as heck didn't know what it was. And I was somewhere around the age of 12 or 13. But before I started drinking, just a real short story. I was raised on a farm. And it explains a lot about my alcoholism. But I was raised on a farm, and we had over 200 head of horses on this farm. And we had a riding stable, and we had exotic animals. We had freak animals. We had all kinds of stuff on this farm. And I remember, it probably about 12 years old before I started drinking, I remember thinking to myself, I don't have a bike. You know what I mean? And the kid across the street, he lived probably about 2 miles away, the nearest house, and he had a bicycle. He didn't have anything else, but he had a bicycle, and I didn't have one. And I realized I wanted it. You know what I mean? And what I did is I stole this kid's bike at about the age of 12 years old because I didn't have one. I had everything else that any kid could ever dream of having, but I was deprived because I didn't have a bike. And he didn't have it for long, and I couldn't ride it because, you know, you got to hide things like that. How are you going to ride something? You have to live on a farm. Where are you going to ride it? But the reason I share that is because I was never satisfied as a young kid. You know, no matter what I had or where I was in life, whatever was going on, I always felt empty. You know, I was never satisfied enough. So I stole that kid's bike. You know, years later after I got sober, I was probably about 8 years sober, I'm doing a meeting up at the Howard County Detention Center in Baltimore. And I shared that story in this jail. And the guy came up to me after the meeting. He says, that was my bike. So I almost felt the urge to make amends to him. But he stopped me and he says, you don't have to worry about that because I stole it from somebody else. It's obvious you just look at where he was, right? You know, he didn't get there because he was the epitome of honesty or anything, you know. But I thought that was pretty funny, you know. And another short story before I got to AA is like going to school and everything. School was pretty difficult for me. You know, like I said, I was raised on a farm, and we had this farm that was in the middle of like a big neighborhood, and all the kids that were going to this school, they'd show up in their nice gym shorts and their nice tennis shoes, and I'd show up, you know, in my cutoff jeans and cowboy boots for gym class, you know. And I would wonder why, and everybody would tease me. I think, man, I just feel like crawling under a wall somewhere and getting away from everybody. It's like that's the way my life always seemed. Like, I always showed up at the wrong time, at the right, wrong place, you know, dressed wrong. Everything was just always wrong. But this night, I was about 13, and I was at a banquet with my parents. And at this banquet, everybody was drinking and laughing and dancing and having a great old time. And I knew most of these people at this banquet. We showed horses with them and all growing up. And most of these people, my impression of them was they always seemed very uneasy. They always seemed very discontented and very miserable and unhappy. But this day, or this evening, they're all drinking and laughing and dancing and having a great time. And it's like I didn't even know who these people were. It's like Bill was dancing with Bob's wife, and Bob said, go have a good time with her. Bring her back when you're done. And, you know, he was drinking, and a few more drinks later, he said, well, just go ahead and keep her. Take her home with you. And I thought that was pretty neat, you know. And I remember thinking, I'm sitting in the back of the room, and just like I always did, and I just wanted to ask this little girl to dance. There was a little 12 or 13-year-old girl out there. And I wanted to get out there just like everybody else was doing. But like what I did here this morning is I said a prayer. And I stood up and I began to share. And I didn't have any of that when I was a kid. So what I did is I started going around to all the tables. I have absolutely no idea what I drank that night. Some people say I'm an alcoholic because I drank beer or I drank whiskey or I drank wine. I have absolutely no idea. I know that I spent the remaining years of my life up until the time I got to A trying to figure out what it was that I drank. But that night, I just started going around all these tables. And somewhere around the third or fourth drink, my life changed. And what I mean by that is that after about the third or fourth drink, I looked back there again, and that little maybe 13-year-old girl's like, somebody replaced her with this model, this supermodel. And she was about 20 years old, and she was waving to me, calling me to the back of the room. And I mean, you couldn't have stopped me that night. I just popped up out of that chair, and I strutted. I didn't walk. I strutted on back there to the back of the room, and it was like somebody else had possessed my body. And I asked that girl to dance that night, and we got up there, and we won a dance contest. I thought we, like, invented dirty dancing at the age of, like, 13. I mean, I was trying to take her clothes off out there, for God's sake. And everybody loved it. They thought it was just the wildest thing they'd ever seen. And we had a wonderful time that night. And if you'd have stopped me right then and there and said, Joe, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? Man, I had the answer. I knew exactly what the answer to that question was. The answer to that question is, I want to drink this stuff, and I want to chase women. Not having a clue what the hell I'm going to do when I catch them, but I'm going to have a lot of fun trying. I'm going to go out of my way to catch as many as I can. And I know there was a lot of them that thought, my God, what the hell did we get ourselves into? But I had a lot of fun drinking, you know, and basically that's what my life was about. It was just about unwinding, about getting outside of myself and just having a good time. Because without the booze, it seemed to me that I just couldn't have a good time. And like I said, if I'd have realized what the booze would have done for me, I'd have started drinking a long time before that. But the booze worked. The booze was my solution. The booze was my solution all the way up to the time I got to AA or got into the 12 steps. Even when it wasn't working, it was still my solution. My ticket into AA, or the hope that I received this time when I got to AA, was that there was a man standing up here just like I am, and I heard absolutely nothing he said that night, except for one thing. And what he said that night was that it seems to me that alcohol allowed me to postpone suicide long enough to get here. And I understood that. You see, because it seems like all of my life up until that point was everything was a struggle, everything seemed hard, and when I began to drink, life became very easy for me. Decisions, it's like I didn't have to think about decisions. They didn't have to ask the question. I already knew the answer. You know, it's just like it was right there to me. And now the sad part about that story is that I think a lot of us go through this. I think I had, it was that red stuff that I drank that night because that's what I had all over me the next morning. That was the problem, you know. But I got in a lot of trouble that night. And I got sick and I blacked out, I believe, because there was a lot of things I don't remember. I got in a lot of trouble. I was 13 years old and I'm not allowed to drink. You know, my parents told me that real early in life. You're not allowed to drink. We do not allow any drinking. They couldn't believe I was an alcoholic. But I got carried home that night. I got in a lot of trouble. And you ever notice that when you screw up, it can't be like maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day to have a talk about your drinking. It's got to be 7 a.m. the next morning. And I was to go through this a lot. 7 a.m. the next morning, we need to have a talk about your drinking, your behavior, your attitude, everything about you. And my parents got me up bright and early the next morning, and they sat me in a chair. And I was sitting in that chair, and somebody had wet my pants the night before because they left me in them. And they threw up all over me because that was all that red stuff that was all running down me. And they sat me in this chair, and I'm not feeling good. You know, and they said to me, Joe, you shouldn't drink. You should not drink. You should not drink as so much as one drink. When you drink, everything about you changes. Your personality, the way you talk, the way you act, the way you walk, everything. It's like you've never read our book. They say you're like a Dr. and Jekyll and Mr. Hyde when you drink. And you shouldn't drink. Bad things happen to you when you drink. Obviously, they weren't looking at the same thing in my life as I was. But that morning, I said to them, I didn't say it to myself, but I said it to them. I said, Mom and Dad, you're right. I shouldn't drink. But deep down inside where the alcoholic lives, you know, if you're anything like me, I said to myself, I said, don't drink. I said, I like the change that happens to me when I drink. I like everything about it that happens to me when I drink. I like the idea that when I put alcohol into my system, all of you mean people become the best friends I've ever had. You know, when I drink, it's like, I just can't wait to do it again. And I didn't say that to them, but I said that to myself. Well, I just can't wait to do that again. Now, I don't know when I had my next drink, but I can assure you, from that moment on, booze was my solution. I pursued alcohol all the way up to the time I got to AA. There was this guy named Herman. He used to live down behind our farm, and old Herman, he was a real alcoholic. I knew what an alcoholic was back then because we had our own alcoholic in our neighborhood. And Herman, he was the kind of drunk. He had, you know, beer bottles all strewn out in his truck and in the back of the bed. And the only paint that was on his truck was other people's and had all kinds of dents on it. You know, and you could always tell when Herman was coming because he never drove a straight line. You know, and Herman had this real bad problem with, well, I don't know if it was Herman or his truck. It seemed like it was his truck because his truck had this knack for like just running into trees. And Herman would fall out of the truck and all these bottles would skewer all over the place and Herman, he would just like lay there. And I knew that's an alcoholic. And if something like that ever happened to me, I'd stop drinking. And I remember talking to him about his drinking as a little kid, you know. And I remember probably about 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm making a little road trip on my moped. I was only probably 14 or so, you know. And I'm going up to the liquor store to get some booze because we're going to have a party tonight. And I don't know about you guys, I like to do a little drinking before the party. And that started real early for me. And so I got down to the liquor store and I loaded up this moped with a couple of cases of beer. And I started to head back up to the farm and I decided to have a drink. And as what I did is I pulled over and I'm sure I had more than one drink because somewhere along the line as I was heading back up to that farm, damn if that moped didn't just like run right off the path and run right into a tree. And I fell off and the bottles were all over the place and I just laid there, you know. And I don't know about you, but my definition of an alcoholic changed that very day. Because I don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't ever remember sitting around in the sandbox with my little friends and like, Larry, what do you want to be? And Larry wants to be a doctor and Sammy wants to be a lawyer and Doreen wants to be a nurse and I think, well, I might need one of them or something like that, you know. And Joey, what do you want to be? Man, I just want to be an alcoholic and destroy every decent thing in my life. Man, doesn't that sound like a fun time? You know what I mean? And I never set out to be an alcoholic. But I was destined to be an alcoholic. That's what I was destined to be. And I didn't pursue to be an alcoholic. I pursued just to... You hear people get up and they talk about how I just wanted to get rip-roaring drunk. I think later on in life I just wanted to get for oblivion. But I just wanted to get to that place where everything was okay. Where I was okay and you were okay and this world I lived in seemed okay. And I don't know exactly how much it was that I had to drink to get there, but I never, and I always overshot that mark. Constantly. Somewhere around the age of 16, I had a lot of problems. And it seems like a lot of people have a lot of problems at 16. And my problems at 16 were always with people who thought they were in charge of me. And I began to have that problem for a long time up until I got to AA. People who thought they were in charge of me. Now, at 16, that means just about everybody is in charge of you. And so I had a lot of problems. I had problems with my teachers, my parents, the judge. I had problems with, like, probation. Not so much probation, but just with the police. You know, just a lot of problems. And so it's what the way I would always solve my problems is I'd have a couple of drinks and think about it. Now, there's nothing worse than you take some problems in your life, at least me, and then you take alcohol and put on top of it and try to come up with an adequate solution. But this is how I solved my problems, and I began to sit there and drink. I was drinking alone when I started. You know what I mean? I like drinking alone. It's like my mind ran wild when I drank that. And I began to examine my life with booze. And what I discovered is I needed to get married. You know, I'm 16 or 17 years old. I need to get away from my parents and in the state of Maryland and just everything about this state. You know, it's just driving me crazy. They won't leave me alone. I didn't realize until after I got sober, police never had to work hard to catch me. I always did stupid things right in front of them. You know? It was like I looked for them and I waited for them to be looking at my way so I would do something. And so I realized that I need to get away from here. And I'm about half drunk at this time, and I'm thinking to myself, I knew this girl in New York. And I knew her for about 2 weeks, and I decided she's the one. You know? And And I'm drinking, and now at 16, you got a lot of problems, right? At 16, I didn't have a job, so therefore I didn't have any money, and if I ain't got no money, I ain't got a car. But my parents have a car lot. Man, what a wonderful gift, you know? And they got this safe. And I watched my mother open this safe one time, and I remembered the combination. How wonderful is that, you know? And I knew that they kept all kinds of things in there that I would be needing. And I'm drinking, and I made this decision. I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to marry this girl. I'm going to open up my own mechanic shop. Now, when I'm sober, I can't change a tire. But when I'm drinking, I can do just about anything I set my mind to doing. And like I said, I got these problems. I got no money. Don't have a car, but my parents had a car lot. So I helped myself to one of their cars. And I opened up the safe, and there was all this money that they weren't even using there. But I thought, well, it's probably mine, man. You know what I mean? And so I took all my parents' money out of the safe. And while I was in there, I noticed that my mother kept her jewelry in there. And I thought my new bride would like some, like, jewelry, you know, some diamonds and some, like, necklaces and things. So I stole all my mother's jewelry, and I packed up the car. And if you're going to open up a mechanic shop, you ought to have some tools, right? You don't want to go there empty-handed. And my brother had these two big toolboxes full of tools. And I figured he wouldn't miss one of them. So I packed up this old 66 Plymouth, and I headed off to New York. That's just the way I did things. I'd come up with an idea in my head, and I would begin to drink, and I would just think it was the most wonderful idea anybody could come up with. And I took off to New York. I forgot to call her, so I got, you know, I figured I ought to give her a call to let her know I'm coming. And so I stopped, and I got me a little $12 room and I up in New York, and I started getting cleaned up, and I finally called her. And she didn't seem as excited as I thought she was going to seem, but nevertheless, you know, she said, well, come on over, are you already here? And so I'm drunk at this time, and so is what I did. This is my life story. So what I did is I got into my little car, and I started heading into town. And what happened is I ran this red light, and I hit a car, and I went to jail. And that's my life story. I would always come up with this wonderful plan on how to fix my life. And it's like I would just have one too many. Just one too many. Or something would happen. Somebody would get in the way. Or just something. Just to throw a wrench in there and screw it all up. And that was a constant in my life. And that was something that was normal to me. Turmoil and just tension and aggravation. Just always. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, they're questioning me. And I've always had this problem, like I said, with lying. And my experience is if you want me to be honest with you, the best way to get honesty out of me is just simply don't ask me any questions and you'll have a pretty good shot at it. But they insisted on asking questions. You know, they're police. I guess that's their job. And the one question they would ask, well, we need to get in touch with somebody to come get you because you're underage. And I remember thinking to myself sitting in this cell at the age of about 16 or 17. I told them that my parents were dead, both of them. rather than face the music, you know, always got to hear. You know what I heard from? I don't know if my parents said this to me, but this is what I always heard. Joe, you are a complete failure. You will never amount to anything. You will never do anything with your life. You know, nothing good will happen in your life. You are a failure. And I remember thinking, sitting in that jail cell at about the age of 6, I was scared to death in there. I panicked so much that they didn't even lock the cell. They were afraid I was going to try to kill myself or something. But I thought to myself, rather than call them and face it, I'd rather just tell them my parents are dead. You know, and that was going to be one of the things that was just about going to kill me before I got to AA. And it's called pride. It's called that unwillingness to accept help. Outside help from people who care about us. It was the thing that was just about going to kill me. But nevertheless, my mother came and got me like she always did. And I ended up back at the farm, you know, the penitentiary, as I looked at it. And I got out of there about the age of 22, something like that. I got away from them. They were managing my life and screwing it all up. So I figured I'd get out there and screw it up myself. And so I got married. I married the woman that I hated. We grew up as little kids. I mean, we're little kids, like 5 and 6. We grew up, and I hated her guts as a kid. I used to spit at her, throw things at her, you know, pour. That's all. I didn't realize that was called foreplay. But it was fine. I hated her. And so I figured, you know, what better person to get married to when you're ready to get married? So I married her, and we had problems from the very start. I think the main problem was is she wanted to fix me and I didn't want to be fixed. Or she wanted to change me and I didn't want to change. I remember she got on me about my drinking one night. And I loved my son, my father-in-law. He was a wonderful man. up until the time he got mad at me, but he was a wonderful man this night. My wife was getting on me about my drinking, and he said, leave the boy alone, for God's sakes. He's just sowing his oats, having a good time. He'll grow out of this. You know, he'll grow up. Give him some time. He didn't know what an alcoholic was. Is what an alcoholic is we don't grow out of this sin. We grow into it. As our literature says, gradually things got worse. And you can be certain that gradually things began to get worse with me. You know, I don't know when. All the way up until that point, I never had a problem with my drinking. Everybody else had a problem with my drinking. Everybody. And I never had a problem with my drinking. But somewhere along this line, at this point in my life, I began to see, you know, DWIs, some people say they never had a DWI. Well, I've had enough for about a couple of us. Okay, so you don't have to go out and get any. I had like five or six of them. Should have had more. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic, I found out. That just makes me a bad driver. How many DWIs I got, or how many times I've been locked up, or how many times I've been divorced, or how many jails I've been to, or how much I drink, or how long I drink, has very little to do with what makes me an alcoholic. But it is what happened is somewhere along this point in my life, I wanted to change. You know, I kind of wanted to grow up a little bit. I began to see that, you know, that everything is beginning to slip away. That, you know, I got tired of paying for lawyers. I got tired of, you know, that's hard. I got tired of losing my license. Like, it really mattered because I drive without them, but I got tired of losing my license. I remember I was probably about 29 years old. I was 29 years old when I got sober, and the courts and the DMV and the judges had my license longer than I did, you know. And there's a problem with that, you know. And I couldn't understand why does this stuff keep happening to me. And then I finally went to this treatment center. Like I said, I went there because I didn't want to go to jail. I went there because, you know, the treatment center or jail, that's an easy decision in the beginning. Later I chose jail because the treatment center didn't work. But I went to this treatment center and I was there for 30 days. And I was voted most likely to succeed in AA leaving that place. And here's the real kicker. They told me that I was the most honest person they ever met. And I lied to them for 30 days. I told them everything I thought they wanted to hear. When they wanted to talk about the family, I painted such a picture of my family. And it wasn't a pretty household growing up, don't get me wrong. You know, there's a lot of blood and there was a lot of fighting. You know, I remember thinking my stepfather killed my brother at the age of 29. I had lawyers out trying to find out what happened there. But I painted such a picture in this treatment center that my parents wanted to come visit me. And they told me, and my parents also, they says, we don't think it would be a good idea for you to come visit him because it might trigger some kind of relapse and he might go get drunk, you know. And because I just told them all kinds of stories. And they says, man, we can understand why you drank, you know. It was awful. But I left this treatment center and I began to try to do something about my drinking. And that's when I began to have a problem with my drinking. When I began to try to do something about my problem. And I didn't really try AA. I kind of tried AA, like a lot of us try AA. I came to AA, and I thought, well, that's trying AA. You know, I came to AA, and I read your steps. You know, when they read the steps and the prologue and the traditions in AA, especially the steps, I remember thinking to myself, the only reason they're reading all that stuff is so we can kill this hour, so we can get the hell out of here and go do what we want to do. I didn't believe that anybody actually did these things. I thought it was just like all filler, just to waste the hours so we can get out of here. You know, I remember going through that treatment center, and they talked about the steps, and they talked about God, and they talked about getting a sponsor, and all kinds of things. And here was my mentality at that point. My mentality is if you get yourself into it, you get yourself out. And that's what I thought I had to do. I knew at that point that I was my enemy. I knew that I created a lot of the problems in my life. And it's what I had to discover is that the mind that created the problems and the mind that got me in all this trouble is not the same mind that I can get out of the trouble with. I cannot solve my difficulties. I've never been able to. I remember when I left that treatment center, they told me things like, you need to work on your problems and work on yourself. Okay, and you need to take charge of your life. And I thought that sounded really good. And it's what I did between that time and the time I got to AA is I took charge of my life. And I made every single decision, and that decision was made by me. And if you didn't like it, that was tough. And by the time I got here, everything about my life was screwed up. I worked on my marriage. I worked as hard as I could on it, and she divorced me. You know, I remember my wife saying to me one night, if you keep drinking, this marriage is over. Now, if you want to know what alcoholism is, here's what alcoholism is. Let's find out if she's kidding. You know what I mean? Let's push it. Let's see how far we can take it. Let's see if she really means what she says. Well, I'm going to report she meant it. And the judge said to me the same thing. Mr. Lear, if you keep drinking, you're going to jail. And he seemed extremely sincere when he made that statement. I don't know why I didn't believe him. You know what I mean? But we got to find out. We got to push it as far as we can. You know, I didn't realize until after I got sober how much I pushed people. And how much I tried to take things completely to the limit. All the way to the end. Somewhere near the end of my drinking, like I was talking about trying to do something about my problem, I went out and being sober for a long time, probably 3 weeks, something like that, I couldn't stand it anymore. Not going to AA, don't misunderstand me, not going to AA. And I got all drunked up. You know how we go out, we get out, we you pick at the wife as much as you can until she finally has it up to here with you. And she says, why don't you get the blankety blank out of here and just get away from me, for God's sakes. And that's my ticket to go get drunk. And so I took her car and her credit cards because I didn't have any left. And I headed to Baltimore, and I lived about 50 miles away up in Carroll County, you know. But I liked to drink in Baltimore. There was a lot more action there. And I never got into too much action. I always got in a corner somewhere. But I just wanted to get away, and I began to drink this night. And just like any other night, I got stinking drunk, and I totaled my wife's car, and I ended up in jail. And the alcoholic hour, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you call the wife up, I'm locked up, you got to come get me, and I'm still drunk, and she's yelling and screaming at me, and I'm thinking to myself, why are you yelling at me? I'm the one that's locked up, for God's sake, just come get me out. So I started yelling back at her, and then a little bit of sanity came. I think you better just shut up, you're not getting out of here. And well, she finally came down and got me, and you see, that's drunkenness. That's all that is drunkenness. But the next day, I don't know if you got to this point, but the next day, I began to look at what I did. And I didn't want to do that. I made a decision that this was going to stop, and I was going to straighten my life out. And I was going to do whatever I had to do that. And here I am, all drunked up again. And look at the mess. Look at the havoc. And I made a solemn oath to myself that this was going to stop. And I promised her. And she bought it. And I thought we should take a trip or something. Get away from here. Get away from Maryland. Just leave all the problems behind us for a while. And just go get away for a while. Get away from your parents. You know how that goes. They're always meddling in our life. They're trying to get you against me so you'll divorce me. And she was buying into this. And I told her, I said, why don't we pack up the kids and go to Disney World or something? Just get away from here. And she thought that was a good idea. So we packed up the kids in the camper, and I was probably about maybe 30, 60 days sober at this time, not drinking, maybe going to 2 or 3 meetings just because I knew I was going to have to go back to court. And we got to Disney World. And the kids, man, they're having a wonderful time. They're riding the rides and playing the games, and just a wonderful time. And the wife, there she is. She's spending all that money I'm going to be needing for that lawyer pretty soon. And she's having a wonderful time, too. And then there's Sober Joe. Sober Joe. He hasn't had a drink for about 2 months now. And the only thing going through Sober Joe's mind at about 2 months sober in Disney World is if that duck or that mouse come up to me one more time, I'm going to punch him right in the mouth. Aren't we just so happy about not drinking that we can't wait to wake up tomorrow morning and start this all over again? You know how that duck and mouse are. They want to hug you. They want to touch you. They want to have their picture taken with you. They won't leave you alone. They follow you around. And the only thing going through my alcoholic mind is I see Busch Gardens over in the corner. And I know if I get over there for a little while, I can relax and have a good time. Now, isn't that insane? The very thing that caused every problem in my life, the only solution I have is to have some more. And it's killing me. And here's what I know at this point. I know the booze is my problem. Knowing the booze is my problem, having all the evidence that booze is my problem, watching my brother die at the age of 29 from alcoholism, knowing that alcoholism kills, being educated about alcoholism, reading books on alcoholism, going to therapy on alcoholism, having all of this information, and knowing that I have it, is not enough to keep me from taking that next drink. And I lived like that for about another year and a half. And the last couple of years of my drinking, I spent more time trying to not drink than I did drink. And you hear about people back talking about how much they drank. It has absolutely nothing to do with how much I drank. It has to do with being powerless over alcohol. Now, when it comes to having the choice over taking that drink, I absolutely have no choice in that matter. Absolutely no choice whatsoever. Like I said, at the end of my drinking, I ended up in the psychiatric ward, and my wife and kids came in to see me. And they said, "Can't you promise that you won't do this anymore?" And like I said, as much as I wanted to make that promise, I knew I couldn't. And I was just about ready for AA at that point. I wasn't quite ready to surrender. I don't think we consciously make a surrender to get here. I think something snaps on the inside. Something breaks. And I think it's the will. And it's what happened at that point in my life is I completely lost the will to live. I had no desire to live. I was married. I had two kids. Was building a house in Carroll County. Had money in the bank, you know. And I couldn't find any reason to live or to go on. And that's alcoholism. It has absolutely nothing to do with the outsides. But it's what I had to do from that point is I had to drink up the outsides. You know, a lot of us, we can get here and we can drink up the insides first. Well, in order for me to drink up the insides, I had to drink up the outsides first. And then I had to drink alone. And what happened to me at that point was, is I finally got into another scrape and I ended up going to court and going to jail. And I'm sitting in the courtroom. And the judge is questioning me. God, I used to hate the questions. She'd ask me the questions. And the questions, here was the first question. "Mr. Lear, anybody with such a problem as yours," just looking at my record, "anybody with such a problem as yours should be going to AA. That's the only thing that we know that helps people like you. Should be going to AA. Are you going to Alcoholics Anonymous?" Now, I wasn't going to AA, but I knew the answer to that question. The answer to that question is, "Yes, ma'am, Your Honor, I'm going to AA." And that's the first lie. And she asked me the second question. "Mr. Lear, seeing as how you're going to AA, do you have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I didn't know what a sponsor was. I kind of put things together in my mind. A sponsor is somebody who gives you money, and I kind of wanted one of them. But I didn't have a sponsor in AA because I wasn't going to AA, right? But I knew the answer to that question. The answer to that question is, "Yes, ma'am, Your Honor, I have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous." And then she asked me the third question. "Mr. Lear, what step are you on in AA?" Now, I'd been to a treatment center not too long ago, so I kind of knew the answer to that question. And the answer to that question is, "Your Honor, I'm on the fourth step." I didn't know what the fourth step was. But the answer to that question is the fourth step. And it's just like about 70% of the rest of AA is on the fourth step. Just like me, I was always on the fourth step. I didn't know what it was, but I was on it. But it's what happened at that in that courtroom. That, all that stuff is unimportant, really. Is what happened is when I left there, because I was supposed to go to jail for about 7 years, and I left there. I didn't go to jail for one day. But it's what I left there with was a man's name and a group's name. And I was told in this courtroom, if I ask this man to be my sponsor and I follow his directions as best I can, I was told in this courtroom that my life would never have to be this way again. And I didn't have to ask them, "Well, what do you mean by my life won't have to be this way?" It was obviously to them what my life was like, and it was more obvious to me what my life was like. And is what happened is I did like any good alcoholic. I came to AA, and I didn't do those two simple things until the pain got great enough. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. My experience has been this. If the pains of being sober get worse than the pains of drinking, if the alcoholic doesn't have a solution, he has to drink. And I knew that was true in my life. Because it's what happens to me every time I stop drinking is the pain comes. And it's what the pain is. I didn't know this until after I got sober. The pain is my life. The pain is everything that happened to me up until the time I get to AA. The pain is my past. The pain, I thought the pain was what everybody else did to me. And the pain is what I've done to everybody else. All the harms I've caused. I couldn't see the harms I caused. I remember one time my mother was having me locked up. The cops are putting the handcuffs on me for stealing from them. obviously. You know, she should have me locked up. But I'm begging her, begging to her, Mom, why are you doing this to me? I'm your son, for God's sakes. And they're still putting the cuffs on me, and they're tightening them up. And she puts her head down and walks away. And I'm drinking. So you know what I said? I said, you blankety blank, 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 blank. It's your blankety fault that my life's all screwed up. And if it wasn't for you, I would never be in this predicament. And she began to cry and walked away. And I never realized. I push people until they have to take such actions as to have me removed. And I've hurt everybody in my life. And I hated my guts. And I didn't know until I got to AA and started going through the steps, you don't have to live that way. Life's not supposed to hurt. And I finally asked that man to be my sponsor. The absolute hardest thing I've had to do. To walk up to another human being and say, will you please help me? And my life changed. I asked that man to be my sponsor. He had some other ideas than I did. I had ideas like take your time, easy does it. I like that easy does it. Easy does it means I don't have to do it today, I can do it later. But he had some ideas like he thought it would be a good idea if we did these steps before I left. Because he knew about alcoholism. I didn't understand alcoholism. He knew that I was leaving. That's what alcoholism is. We're new. We're trying to find a way to get out of here. He knew that I'm leaving. As much as I want to be here, as much as I found some people in AA. I loved people in AA. And I wanted to be with these. And I wanted to stop drinking. But all people think that that third tradition gives us a ticket in here, you know. We talk about that third tradition like there's really something major going on. That when I say the third, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And we think that's our ticket into AA, and that's not a ticket into AA. I had a desire to stop drinking 5 years before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that desire never availed me absolutely nothing. But I asked this man to be my sponsor, and he thought it'd be a good idea if we did these steps before I left. And so we got involved with the steps immediately, and I began to pray to a guy that I didn't believe in. My sponsor, at one time in his life, he was a very religious man, and when I heard him talk about God, I knew he understood God. And I didn't understand God. I didn't trust in God. I didn't believe in God. I didn't realize until after I began to dig a little deeper that I looked at God like I looked at me. And like I told you, I was a failure in every department of my life. And I was a user of people, and I hurt people. And if God is the same way, I cannot turn my will and my life over to the care of this God. If God is anything like me, vindictive, punishing, scorekeeping. And now I kind of looked at God that way. And I had this sponsor who believes that God loves everybody equally. And I didn't think that was true. And the reason I didn't think that was true is because I knew what was inside of me. I knew what I had done at that point. But I began to pray to this God that I didn't believe in. And I began to go through the motions of the 12 steps. I did a first step with my sponsor. I did a second step. And I did the third step with my sponsor. And then I got to writing my fourth step. And this is where I found the God of my understanding. I didn't find the God of my understanding in the meetings or in the book or in anybody's words. I found the God of my understanding when I sat down and I began to write my fourth step. And when I began to look at it, there was four things on my fourth step that had to do with drinking. And I'm not going to tell you what they were, but I can assure you most of us have about four or five things that had to do, major things that had to do with drinking. The rest of my fourth and fifth step was basically my self-will. It was my ego and my pride and my self-centeredness. It was me, basically me attempting to live my life based on what I thought I should do. And it's what I began to realize when I started writing my fourth step. Is this is my best efforts to manage my life. Everything I had up until that point. And when I began to look at all of that on that paper is what I realized, if I don't find the God of my understanding, I ain't going to make it. Because I've been trusting in me ever since I was a little kid. And I'm trusting a known failure to manage my life. I'm trusting a nut to manage my life. You know what I mean? That's what I'm trusting, me, a nut, to manage my life. If I don't find some kind of a power, I'm not going to make it. And my prayer life began to change. My prayers began to change to the point where it wasn't so much, do I believe or don't I believe? There was more along the lines, God, I hope you're there and I hope you're listening. Because if I have to live on my own, I ain't going to make it. Will you please show me what it is you want me to do? And life became extremely easy at that point. At that point, I was about 3 months sober. I was being divorced. I couldn't see my kids. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to live. And by the way, sponsors love to hear your problems, okay? So if you got a sponsor, use them. That's how I look at it. They love problems. It's like they don't have any problems in their life, and they're real happy that you're all screwed up, you know? And I began to tell my sponsor all of my problems. I said, Tom, I'm being divorced. And we knew that. And I can't see my kids, and I don't have a job, and I don't have a place to live. I need about $30,000 and a good lawyer, and the judge took my license, and I don't have a car. And he says, well, stop right there, Joe. So I stopped for a moment. I had some more problems I wanted to talk about, but I stopped right there. And he says, if you don't have a car, Joe, you don't need a license. Okay? See how fast AA's working in your life? You just got here, and you got one problem solved already. Isn't that wonderful? And he laughed like you guys did, and I'm ready to choke him or something, you know? Because I didn't find it funny whatsoever, you know? So I stopped telling him my problems at that point. It wasn't that I didn't have any more, but I just stopped telling him. But I'm about 3 months sober at this time, and all those things are happening in my life. My life is falling apart. Is what it means to catching up. And something happened in here. And what happened in here is much more important than what can take place on the outside. As I began to develop this relationship with God that you were talking about. I didn't know that's what it was. I just knew that I found the comfort inside of me. I found the comfort in here at Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew for 1 hour that I was okay. And it's what happened as a result of the 1 hour in here with you and with my sponsor. That began to trickle into every area of my life without any effort on my part. I remember thinking, you know how they read the 12 promises in AA, and I remember sitting up front being new because my sponsor said I had to sit up front. Not that I wanted to sit up front, I wanted to sit in the back. But I sat up front and they would read the promises and I'm new. And they would get to the promises like self-seeking will slip away. And I remember being new and thinking to myself, man, I hope that doesn't happen to me. Self-seeking was, I mean, I lived my life based on that. Self-seeking. Here's another one. I didn't like this one either. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. And I think, I hope that one never happens, you know? God, that sounds awful. But that's called alcoholism. It's self-centeredness. And it's what happened as a result of just simply following the motions, like going through the rest of the steps. That change that happened in here has never left. Not for one day have I ever thought to myself, I'm not going to be okay. Regardless of what's going on the outside, not for one day have I believed that I'm not going to be all right. It doesn't mean that adversity hasn't occurred in my life. A lot of things have happened since I've been sober. My mind can drive me crazy, left up to its own devices. But not once have I ever felt, I mean really felt, like I'm not going to be all right. And that's the complete reason I drank. That is the total reason I picked up the booze and began to drink. And this happened automatically. And I tell you how I know that it was God, because I couldn't tell you when it happened. I just know that one day, it's like I came to, and it's like it was like a different world. And I don't know exactly when that took place. I know that my sponsor thought it would be a good idea if we continued with the steps, and I wasn't ready to rush out. I mean, I was really happy about where I was, you know. But he knew that we have to go on, you know. We got to go on. This is not an end in itself. We have to continue. The most two important things I've learned since I've been in AA is not a whole lot of stuff. It's real simple. It's start and continue. I was a great starter in a lot of things in my life, but I've never been able to continue nothing. So we went through the rest of the steps, and I'd just like to talk about the eighth and ninth step for a little bit. And I had my stepfather, I hated his guts. I remember I was about 11 years old, my brother was 13. And we were making plans on how to kill this man. You know, at the age of 11 and 13, that's pretty smart. And we had some horse tranquilizers, some stuff you give to a horse, and it take them out completely. And we're thinking, well, how much do we got to put in his food to really end it for him, you know? And this is the way I was living. And after I got sober, I done some stealing from him. My thinking was always this, is if you didn't pay me accordingly what I thought you should pay me, I didn't call it stealing, I called it compensating myself. So I was compensating myself at this time, and I was getting honest with my sponsor. He knew all this stuff, and he says, well, you got to give that stuff back. And I remember thinking, I'm new, and I'm thinking, well, but it's mine. He said, it's not yours, Joe, it doesn't belong to you. So that's how I kind of began to make my amends to him. And I took the stuff back, and I told him that I was an AA. He knew that. And I told him one of the things that I had to do in order to recover is I had to make restitution to harms that I caused people, make amends. And he said, you know, it's no big deal to him. But about a month and a half later after that, he had to go into the hospital for open heart surgery. And I didn't think any more about it at that point. You know, I just figured, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, cleaning my side of the street. If he goes and dies, it ain't no big deal. That's what I thought. And it's what happened between that time and the time when he went in the hospital. My sponsor says, you need to go see him. So I went to see him. And it's what happened. I walked up to him, and it was like I was completely outside of myself. And I walked up to him, and I put my arms around him. And I gave him a big hug, and I told him I loved him a great deal. And that I forgave him for everything he ever done to me. And I told him, I said, I hope you can forgive me. And all that hatred went away. And it's never came back. All of it. And that's been the experience of all of my amends. You know, we're not supposed to live in pain. God never put us here to punish us. All of this stuff was brought on by my living, my self-will. And until I make an attempt to clean it up, it's not going to change. It just doesn't change. I made amends to the rest of my family, and I continue to make amends. I think that the most important thing in my life today is the God of my understanding. That's the relationship that I have with Him. And there's a lot of people in AA, and I love all these people, and I believe them because it's their experience. But a lot of us, we have this belief that we have to go out and we got to find this God of our understanding. And I'm here to tell you the only way that I've been able to find a God of my understanding is by trying to help other people in AA. It seems to me like God put this in such a way that in order for me to get well and to recover, I have to help other people. I have to be willing to get outside of myself and help somebody else. And I didn't realize that would become the main solution in my life. Everything about this relationship that I have with God is based on trying to help somebody else. I benefit by helping other people. My life always gets better by trying to help somebody else. And I'm not talking about patting me on the back or something like I'm somebody special or nothing. I'm talking about that is all I have to do is share my experience. I'm not there to tell anybody what to do. I'm not here to tell anybody in this room what to do or to stop drinking or to get better or to change your life. I'm here to tell you that as a result of following simple, clear-cut directions, my life has changed. Everything about my life has changed by following simple, clear-cut directions. And that means not adding anything to it or taking anything away. It even means that I need to try to get a little bit more honest. Doesn't mean I have to get overwhelming honest, just a little bit each day, just a little bit. Don't become so overwhelming that, like, you've got to become a saint by next Thursday or something. Just try to get a little bit honest each day. And it's what I realized is that all God wants for me is to be happy, joyous, and free, like our book says. And to the extent that I do these things, that has been true. One of the other things I'd like to share before I close is that when I was newly sober, I thought I would never have anything in my life. My life was going to be, you know, just sort of just constant problems growing up, like I was did all my life. And I mean, today, you know, I'm going to be married again, you know, and I got a wonderful job making more money than I ever made. I got a home. I bought a home. And all that stuff is not as important as being here with you today. Absolutely. None of that stuff is nowhere near as important as being here with you. And some people could never understand that. And I'm here to tell you why. The reason that is because if I'm not here with you, absolutely none of that stuff is possible in my life. And I'm firmly convinced of that. And I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to come out and share with you. And I think that I'm out of time.